Next up on Off Duty, meat and beer.
Helping you enjoy the finer points of food and drink. This is Off Duty from the Wall Street Journal.
Welcome to the Off Duty podcast, where we talk about all things food and drink. This is a special best of episode. We're going to teach you how to be a beer geek in one of my favorite segments from November. But first, we chat with a legend in the food world, Ariane Dagan, the owner of meat and game purveyor D'Artagnan. In this conversation from November, she tells us how she went from being a college dropout to creating one of the most important groundbreaking culinary companies in America.
Well, prepare to get officially hungrier. Our next guest, Ariane Dagan, is a legitimate legend. That word's overused, but she really is a legend in the food world. Her company, D'Artagnan, sells some of the best meat, poultry, and game in the country, in the world, really. And this weekend's off-duty section pays a visit to her kitchen at home in Manhattan. She's here now with us to share some tips today. Welcome, Ariane.
Hey, thank you. Thank you. And thank you for the legend.
It's true.
Wow.
You can get that as a tattoo now.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's official.
I can get on a pedestal and not move anymore.
Well, I mean, I understand congratulations are also in order because this fall is D'Artagnan's 30th anniversary. How did you get into this business in the first place?
It was almost a fluke, except on one side and not really on the other. I mean, I'm the seventh generation of restaurateurs and people in the food business in Gascony, southwest France. My father had a 2 Michelin stars restaurant. And his grandfather had a restaurant, et cetera, et cetera. And so I was born in it, you know. But because I was a girl, I was the eldest, but I was a girl, so it was never a question. My brother was going to be the one taking over the hotel restaurant one day. It was never said, but it was always clear, you know, in the path of what we are doing and helping the restaurant and all that. So I wanted to become a journalist. I like to write. And so I came in America to learn more about English, which, as you can see, didn't improve much for the last 30 years.
It's true. Better than my French.
And I think you chose the better profession, trust us.
And I went to Columbia University. I dropped out a year later, didn't have enough money to continue. Even though I was working part-time for a little charcuterie at the time, and so they took me on full-time. I stayed there for 5 years, and in the fifth year, one day, a couple of guys came in with a foie gras in their hands, telling us that they were going to start a duck for foie gras farm. And so that was, for me, it was pretty much history. You know, that was what I knew about from my family, from the farmers around, from the whole region in Gascony is about fowl and geese and ducks, and so I that's it. You know, it was a call. I started my company then in 1985.
But that must have been something. Duck foie gras must have been something pretty unusual, stateside at that time.
It was historical for me because there was none. There was no, that would have been, that was the very first farm to do that. So it was also very exciting because kind of at the same time in France, it was starting to become a little bit of a factory farming, you know, where there was so much competition that people were competing to have the cheapest stuff, not the best stuff. Mm-hmm. So to see here people who were not worried about that and who were just worried about trying to produce the best of the best, that was very, very exciting.
And does your French upbringing shape the way you cook at home in your own kitchen?
Not only my French, but my Gascon, my southwestern French. We have in Gascon, you know, in France, you can divide France in four. In four big squares. One is butter, one is cream, one is pork fat or olive oil. So butter and cream together, pork fat, olive oil, and duck fat, duck and goose fat. So I'm in the goose fat and duck fat square.
That's a good square to be in, I think.
Yeah, it is a very good, yes, because it's very good for your health. You know, it's a good animal fat. There is a large amount of unsaturated fat that make a good cholesterol, the HDL. So, and that's why we think in Gascony we live longer than in other regions of France. But so in my kitchen, I cook regional dishes, or not necessarily, but I certainly cook with the same techniques and with the same base, the duck fat to start with.
Well, I understand that in addition to doing some serious cooking at home, you also do some serious card playing. What's your game?
Well, once in a while on Sundays, maybe I'm going to say one every three Sundays or one every four Sundays, the guys come, my friends come for a poker game. But it's friendly. It's not, don't think a smoky room with thousands of dollars and an armed guard at the entrance. It's very, very much amateurish, but a lot of fun. I think we spend more time eating than playing, but once we start playing, we're pretty serious, and we're pretty serious, except when the guy who's supposed to bring the tokens forget them. So then he goes down and buys gummy bears and stuff like that, and we play with gummy bears. But it's friendly, but it's like everything.
Gummy bears doesn't sound very French. I'm not sure, though.
No, to play with. You're not.
Oh, to play. Okay. I'd be tempted to eat them the whole time. So.
That would be dangerous to the game, I think.
Yeah, some people do. So every time you do that, you lose 50 cents.
It's a whole new element to poker.
Okay. I think that the Armagnac, I'm guessing, flows pretty freely during these games.
Yes. Well, because we eat first. So the game is after dinner. So, of course, there is a digestive. And the only digestive at my home, I shouldn't say totally the only one, but certainly the big one at my home is Armagnac.
Armagnac, what sorts of different ones do you have? Do you have a collection of it?
Over time, I was lucky enough to get an accumulation of really good bottles and vintages from Tariquet, from Lobad, from Saint Malens, from Gelas, all the Daroz, all those guys have, you know, it's not like wine, where a good year in a region is good for the whole region. This is because it's distilled spirits. It's house by house, you know, it's a different, you have to know that 1939 Saint Malens is an exceptional Armagnac. And then 1982 Tariquet is an exceptional Armagnac, but 82 is not necessarily good for Saint Malens, or you know what I mean? It's not about. Mm-hmm. So you have to basically put yourself in the hands of the producer, who's going to tell you which vintage of his is the extraordinary. I mean, then it's pretty well known, you know, but the best ones you kind of know because it's been published. But that's how it works. So I have a lot of those vintage. And when you're really proud of a year that went really well, then you put everything of that year in a vintage instead of going in a VSOP, you know, those 4 years old or XO 12 years old, which are good Armagnac, but it doesn't have that special something that the vintage has.
Now, something a little bit, well, kind of complicated, I think. The Berkshire pork baby back ribs, is that, I mean, I'm looking at sort of the ingredients. This is a recipe you shared with us. But is it something the average home cook can approach?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the Berkshire is because we use that pork. That's the pork we sell to all our client chefs. Mm-hmm. And Berkshire pork, that breed, is a heritage breed. So it's fattier, richer in taste, more marbled. That animal has aged longer than your regular commodity pork, so it's going to be a better taste. But you can do that with any pork you like. And what I was looking for, something that would be finger food, so we could start playing in the same time, possibly, which my friends eventually don't do anyway because it's still sloppy. You know, you still have to wipe your hands, and because we eat the baby back ribs, you eat with your hands basically. So, but still, now I can't escape because they like it a lot. my poker partner, so I have to do it every time now.
Yes.
Well, what's not to like? Poker and pork ribs. It sounds like the recipe for a dinner party I'd definitely want to be invited to. Thank you so much for talking to us today, Ariane.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Like any world populated by the obsessed, craft beer speaks its own language. With so much to drink, the old standard lingua franca of mild and stout, double and single, heck, even the days where you could just ask for a beer are long gone. So we asked our resident beer writer, William Bostwick, back in December to provide us with a guide to navigating the brave new craft beer universe. Beth, I don't know about you, but I spent a lot of time in geeky bars. It's work, you know?
Oh, I know how hard you work at drinking.
Yes.
But what do you mean when you say geeky bars?
Well, there's the cocktail bars, right? The ones with the menus, and the drinks have things like yellow chartreuse or barrel-aged gin in them. I've been drinking them for a pretty long time, and so I'm in my element there. But then, you know, I like beer. I try to sort of go to those kind of geeky beer bars a lot. But I just feel out of my element there. You know, it's like the other day I heard someone say, what's the closest thing you have to a heady topper? And I was like, what? What's a heady topper?
I beg your pardon. And then there are all those different kinds of hops. I feel like we're all supposed to know what they all are and taste like and ask for them these days. It's a lot to keep track of.
Yeah, the beer snobbery is it's or I should say beer geekery. Beer geekery is its own special kind of geekery. Fortunately, we have beer writer William Bostwick with us. He's going to be doing a regular column for the new Off-Duty blog that will help us expand our knowledge of the beer universe every week. And his first column is a guide to understanding things that beer geeks say in the hopes of maybe becoming a beer geek yourself. He's here now. William, thanks for joining us.
Hi, guys. Thanks.
All right, let's start with the thing I overheard. This was at Svoy & Duyvil, which is one of the geekiest beer bars in the country, I think. So what is a heady topper?
Heady topper. So heady topper is...
I love saying heady topper. Just rolls off the tongue.
But it's not just any beer. So every year or so, every season, every couple of years, there's a new cult favorite beer that geeks everywhere kind of go nuts over. And you know, the smaller the batches, the more isolated the brewery, the better. So for years, it was a beer made by a little brewery in Northern California called Russian River, and the beer was Pliny the Younger.
Yes.
But that has lately been unseated by a new beer out of Vermont. The brewery is called Alchemist, and the beer is called Heady Topper. And Heady Topper is it's an IPA. It's a double. They might even call it a triple IPA. So it's very strong, and it's very it's very hoppy. So hop heads go nuts for that. But really, most of its appeal is just how hard it is to get. You have to drive to the brewery in Waterbury, Vermont. You got to wait in line. You know, cases go up for sale on the Craig's Market blacklist every once in a while. But, you know, really, this is a beer that, you know, only the devoted can get.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. So it's kind of like the, you know, in the whisker world, we have our Pappy Van Winkle. The beer world has their Pliny, which I guess is now, you know, not as coveted as the heady topper.
Yeah, not as coveted, and you know what? Next year, it's going to be another one. There's going to be a little brewery in, southern Florida that just puts out 5 cans of their super special release, and that'll be that year's heady topper. But for now, it's Waterbury, Vermont, Alchemist Brewery heady topper. So ask for it, and you'll get, laughed out of bars.
Well, I've been seeing this term thrown around, IBUs. Some of the craftier beers are stating this number on their bottles, like their cars advertising horsepower or something. What does that mean?
Well, that's a really good analogy. IBUs is, it's interesting. It's one of the few geeky terms that we have that actually does have some science behind it.
IBU
stands for International Bittering Unit. And what it does is it measures basically how bitter a beer is. And the bitterness of beer comes from acids in the hops. So in simple terms, the more acid a certain hop variety has, and the more of that hop is used in a beer, the more acid is dissolved in that beer, and the higher the IBUs. So one IBU is equal to 1 milligram of this bitter acid dissolved in 1 liter of beer.
This is like a science lesson you're getting.
Beer menu, and it might say, this beer is a 50 IBU beer, a 100 IBU beer. You have a relative gauge of how bitter it is. But one thing to keep in mind, though, is that there's so much more going on in a beer besides the hops. So you might have, a beer that just by the numbers has a relatively low IBU rating, maybe a 50 or a 60. But if that beer also has, very mellow grains, maybe it's just a pale wheat beer or a really light pilsner, that hop character is really going to come through a lot more than if it were, say, a 75 or 100 IBU beer, but there were also really dark roasted malts, maybe some coffee or chocolate or other flavors going on there. So, it's one way of figuring out how beer is going to taste, but it's not the whole story.
Got it. All of that was super geeky, but which is good.
How geeky can we go?
Yeah. What is the geekiest thing you can say, if you want to impress someone?
Well, okay. So, obviously you could ask for a heady topper. You could ask for a beer that, make up a beer and, ask for something no one's ever heard of. But that might just get you laughed out of the bar.
Because no one's going to have a heady topper.
Because no one's going to have it. Exactly.
Yeah. You can't go around asking for Pappy everywhere. It's like people are like, get out of here. What are you talking about?
Right. So one thing I like to do, and this is geeky, but it actually works. It has a benefit that I'll get to. So, if you like sour beers, a lot of bars, they might have a sour on tap, but it's more likely that your beer bar will have a good bottled beer selection, and that's where you're going to find most of your sours.
Got it.
Now, they'll keep most of those beers, obviously, in a fridge behind the bar. But if you're a geek like I am, you will see a sour on the menu that you like and ask for it from the cellar. Don't ask for it from the fridge. See if they'll give it to you cellar temperature or room temperature. And try it that way. I really enjoy my sours warmed up, because sometimes when they're ice cold straight from the fridge, the sourness gets very sharp and very one note, and you don't get all the rich, fruitier flavors that develop when these beers warm to temperature. So that's a really geeky thing you could do, is say, I'd love to try this Russian River Consecration. I see you have the 2014 version. I'm wondering if you could just grab that from the basement for me. And then obviously you can ask for it in a brandy snifter or something to really up your geekdom.
Or you just bring your own brandy snifter to the bar.
Okay. That's
your monogrammed
brandy snifter. Oh, I love it. Kevin, that's great.
I'm not joking. I do that. Wow. I did not know that. Ask for the beer from the basement, from the cellar. Will bar people be like, that's cool, we'll do that for you, or?
Yeah. If you're at a bar, you definitely read the bar you're at. You know, if you're at Mick Sullivan's Irish, football pub, maybe don't go for that.
Don't ask for your Budweiser at cellar temperature.
Exactly.
Okay, got
exactly.
it.
And then pour the Bud Light into your snifter.
Okay.
Perfect.
But if you're at a bar, if you can tell that they have a pretty well-curated beer list, if you can tell that they have a pretty good stock of some vintage sours, some old bottles, chances are the bartender will be pretty hip to that game.
That's great. I'm going to start asking for that. Cellar temperature beer all the way. William,
there you go.
Thank you so much for joining us. This was awesome.
Thanks, guys. Anytime.
Thanks for listening to this special Best of Off-Duty podcast. For more podcasts, check us out at wsj.com/podcast. Become a subscriber on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and now look for us on Google Play Music app on Android devices. And follow us on Twitter at WSJ Podcasts.
WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously.